One, two.
Thank you.
I'm going to go to the next one. Welcome again to our MIT students. The agenda for today is up on the screen, a fairly simple agenda this week, Trusted Systems. And we have a guest panel, and I understand we also have some shadow guests in the room. Hal Abelson has been at work securing up some other guests who can probably know who you are, and you should feel free to move to identify yourself and jump in. In the meantime, we also have formal guests because we have such a proliferation of computer equipment at the front table. Not sure what all of them done. Our guests have been displaced off to the side of the room. And you may recognize them because they are from among the class. They are students whom the bot and I'd love for them to identify themselves as we get going. So I want to start with Kevin Boyle, citizen. No small task, and I think perhaps in preparation for your pencil, you're wearing a Mickey Mouse t-shirt.
Mickey Mouse, which is my improper trademark partnership. All right, to your right is Jessica Meyer from Simon & Schuster, Turner & Murdoch, the newly merged publishing conglomerate.
I'm a publisher, and I'm representing the interests of the publisher.
Okay, we also have Alvin Dupree, writer and artist.
Yes, my name is Alvin Dupree. I'm here to represent all of us out there who have more to create and stuff.
Wonderful.
My name is Glenn Brown, and I'm today a member of Congress, so I'm here to please everyone at all times.
Congratulations, you're well on your way to the election.
I'm John Paul Creed, a PhD in library sciences and the president of the Association of Public Libraries, representing the real public interest, unlike the U.S. Congress.
I'm Janelle Frigo, and I'm representing software developers and their interests.
Wonderful. I see you're from the Trusted PC Alliance. Please, no kissing until the end. So you're just going to very happy to kiss one cathartic noise. Okay, so I wanted to get started with our panelists by figuring out what are the various interests at stake here. Now, among the readings, at least on the law side of things, was this recent announcement of the Trusted PC Alliance. The Trusted PC Alliance. And I actually managed to fish out a press release. This is actually from PC World Magazine. Safety for Surfers. PC heavyweights form alliance to build an open source security model for web products. Building on the notion that the ultimate internet security product is part software, part hardware, and a whole lot of trust, five leading hardware and software companies are forming an open source alliance on Monday to promote safer surfing and shopping. The group known as the Trusted Computing Platform Alliance plans to write framework specifications that will guide hardware and software developers toward building products that will provide security when you're online. Participants include Compaq, Hewlett Packard, IBM, Intel, and Microsoft. So that was quite a list of heavy hitters in the Trusted Computing Platform Alliance. And the rest of the piece does not elaborate any further than what you all have just heard. That's the purpose of this alliance. So far as we know, the purpose of the alliance is to promote safer surfing and shopping. I'm wondering, Ms. Kevos, if you can fill us in any more on what you think this alliance is out to do.
Well, basically, what we're trying to do is make it easier and make it safer for people to use the internet, because security is probably one of the most, for internet users, security is a very, very important issue, and we want to make sure that, you know, internet users are guaranteed, you know, almost, you know, perfect security when they're using the net. And I think the idea that we're driving by is that if we try to build in security mechanisms into the hardware, into the software, then, you know, the security guarantees are more reliable.
So I imagine if we were to take a poll and see how many people were in favor of security, there would be resounding consensus that people want that, they're happy to have that. So when you say security, as a consumer, for instance, let's ask a consumer. Who is our consumer once again? Kevin Boyle, Citizen. Kevin, you're a net surfer. What does that description tell you as to what this alliance is coming together to do? What is the security all about from what you can tell?
Scalability for me to buy things safely online.
What are the dangers of buying things online? What are the dangers that the security will protect you from? What do you want to be protected from?
From hackers breaking in and taking my credit card numbers.
Your credit card number. So is that what this alliance is about, as far as you know, Ms. Carlos? Is this an alliance about stopping hackers from getting the credit card numbers of innocent citizens like Mr. Boyle and using it to ring up huge bills on computer equipment that ends up on a desk like this?
Well, it's not only about, you know, preventing, you know, hackers from getting, you know, credit card information or medical information and that type of thing. We want to ensure that, you know, the basic, you know, integral security, you know, requirements of any security mechanism are ensured. We want to make sure that, you know, people are guaranteed of authenticity, of integrity of the data coming, you know, the data that they're, you know, dealing with. We want to ensure that there is confidentiality, which is what, you know, Kevin was talking about earlier. We want to ensure that there is
So it goes beyond just preventing hackers, you know, from breaking into your information. You want to be sure that, you know, anybody else, just any random person is, you know, prevented. So it's not just, you know, the people who go about it maliciously.
Okay.
You want to be sure that, you know, you're...
So let me ask you again, there's another thing in this press release that strikes me, not just security, because building on the notion of the ultimate internet security product, it's software, hardware, and a whole lot of trust. So Kevin, as a citizen, let me ask you, what does trust mean to you? What's trust about?
Trust is having someone who
is looking out for you. This is a system you can trust. Is what you're saying. You want a system that will look out for your interests. You can trust it. You know it's safe. Ms. Bell, is that what trust means? Feel free to call an expert witness if you feel the need.
Well, in that case, I'd probably like to call on Professor Hal Abelson to give us a clear explanation of what trust means in this context.
Professor Abelson, what does trust mean to you?
I've been a technical advisor to the Trusted Platform Internet Alliance, and people in this country simply aren't aware of all the terrible things that can happen. That as you start using Internet Commerce more and more, will become better and better opportunities for thieves. People don't realize you could open a piece of electronic, an innocent piece of electronic mail, read that, that could install, as you're opening it, a virus on your computer, which would have the property that when you then access your bank account, will store away your password and send it to some nefarious person as part of some criminal organization who will then immediately proceed to shuffle money through your bank account and use it for money laundering and drug smuggling and buying pornography.
I always thought how computer scientists so pain to scare people. You know, it comes out so naturally, these things that are terrifying.
So what we need is an architecture of trust, which means that when you run this software, someone has certified, one of the members of the Trusted Platform Alliance has certified and guaranteed that this software does what it's supposed to do, and no more and no less. It's just like when you plug in your toaster, you want to be able to trust that it will not catch fire. And what we want to do in the Alliance is to make sure that people have trust in the consumer products that we're putting out to that same standard.
So are the trusters only the consumers and the trustees are the platforms they're using, just like I'm trusting my toaster, or is there another trust relationship involved?
The trusters are, of course, all of us and the whole society, because it's not merely the people who make the toaster, it's the people who run the restaurants that use the toaster, it's the people who write programs that are built on the programs that are around, and ultimately it comes down to you have to be able to trust the manufacturer of the computer who will provide guarantees to the maker of the software. And so what's needed is what's usually called a trust infrastructure. And without that, we cannot realize the promise of the Internet.
Wow, this is running press releases. Amazing. Great here. I still don't know if we're at the bottom of trust. Let me ask our publisher, from your point of view, what does trust mean to you?
Trust in my business means something different than just credit card numbers. I represent a lot of authors who are interested in putting their works online, and from an author's perspective, trust comes into play. The novel wants to make sure that if he or she puts information online, it's not going to be downloaded by every Tom, Dick, and Harry and spread around the country without legitimately paying for it. Authors are looking to me as a publisher to ensure that any time that their work is downloaded off the web, someone is paying the fee that we've agreed on, and if that person isn't then going to pass out that information to all of his or her friends, that information will stay with the rightful buyer. That's trust from an author's perspective.
So tell us, is this platform designed to vindicate that kind of trust as well as the consumer kind of trust that Tom, Dick, Harry, and Kevin are expressing.
Well, I wouldn't actually say that this our Trusted PC Alliance is geared at doing that specific type of trust. However, the whole idea is to have both parts. So okay, yes, I'm sorry. Because the whole idea is what kind of software can we write to facilitate the type of trust that she's talking about? And this is where you think about things like digital watermarking and digital containers and that type of thing. And this is exactly what we're aiming to produce.
So what we're learning so far is that trust can be a two-way street. We can do a platform that brings the five giants of modern cyberspace together for the purpose not only of allowing Kevin to trust that when he buys something online, nobody is going to take his credit card number or the product he gets won't become a Trojan horse running amok into his computer, but also so that Ms. Meyer can trust that Kevin is only getting what he paid for and no more and no less. Does that sound right? So trust is a two-way street is the lesson of the first module, figuring out trust. I can see why the PC Week people have a hard time parsing a press release into this understanding. So let me just ask Mr. Dupree, as a writer and an artist, what are the trust relationships that you enter into that perhaps, so long as we are making more abundant trust all around, you ought to benefit from this too?
Well, John, I think there's a lot of aspects that are involved there, but my current publisher here, one for most of us already, we place a lot of our trust in publishers. And they're the people that sort of deal with all this technical stuff that we don't really know too much about. We primarily we like to make sure that we get acknowledged, we like to be able to trust for that sort of thing. We also, since sort of like our method of living, our way of life is out there, our means of survival, we like to make sure we get something back for what we do. And so we need to really have a lot of trust, not only in the publisher, but also, I guess that sort of means something called, what is it, ISP? Is that something that you know about? I don't know. Anyway, something, whatever it is that's out there that lets people, plug their computers into the wall and, talk to other computers in other parts of the world. We need to make sure that won't let them take
right, the computer, right?
That's what you're right. Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah, but it doesn't go too much beyond that, I don't believe.
Now, not to delve into the details of some of your contracts that I understand you have assigned with Schuster, Turner, and Murdoch, or more accurately, that were assigned to sign with Schuster, Turner, and Murdoch when the latest merger happened, approximately what percentage do you get of royalties off of a work that you offer? Apparently, Ms. Meyer knows your contracts better than you do. Why don't we ask Ms. Meyer?
Apparently, yes.
Yeah.
I think we just didn't want to tell you, actually, is the reason you don't know. I think we as the publisher get about 90% of royalties from what you've written.
Pretty good.
We think so.
Pretty good deal. So who on the panel is feeling starry-eyed about the prospects of what the internet brings? This relationship, which Mr. Dupree describes as one of trust, one that either this new platform in specific or the internet generally is going to disturb. Are Ms. Meyer's and Mr. Dupree's interests perfectly aligned here? Is there anybody who wants to speak to that who isn't one of those two? Mr. Brown, I understand that before you became a member of Congress, you worked hard on so-called MP3 issues. So I don't know, maybe you can answer that question.
On the question being whether or not their interests are aligned.
Have their interests vis-a-vis each other shifted thanks to the advent either of the internet or this new particular piece of it?
It shifted in the first place because of the internet, arguably in favor of artists because they were able to circumvent the publishing and filtering process and put out their own work and get it out there.
Well, why would they want to do that? So saying he's going to go around, he's going to violate the trust Ms. Meyer has in him and go around her to put his stuff on the internet?
Possibly, yeah. It might just be easier than all to deal with the contracts and the lawyers and all of that. It also might be a matter of having more control over your own stuff and getting to say where some things are, your books in your case, are going to look like or read them.
Does that sound good to you, Mr. McCarthy?
I'm not actually so sure. I just sort of believe everything my publisher tells me.
You're behaving like a good artist, but now is another source of information. Mr. Brown, to your left, has just alerted you. Wait a minute, the internet is here. You don't need this publisher anymore, right? Isn't that a siren song luring you to the internet without the aid of a publisher?
Well, it does sound very interesting, but that's not what my publisher says.
Ms. Meyer, what do you say to this?
My artist, he really knows what he's talking about. Going around the publisher is a bad idea for everyone involved. It's a bad idea for my friend here because without me to represent his work, I'm the one who does the marketing and the placement. People rely on me as a publisher there's an expectation of quality that people, when they come to Simon & Schuster and Turner and Murdoch, they know what they're getting. Without me, people are going to not be able to discern a great author from a mediocre author. So it's in his interest to keep me because I'm doing this marketing and placement. In terms of the general public, you people need me to do that filtering. Imagine going online looking for a book, you're just kind of a sci-fi, you're into a sci-fi novel, so you go online, there will be millions of sci-fi works online, and there will be no way for you to discern a quality writing from the novice.
So this is kind of a Borgesian view that says, yeah, the internet is like a big library, and now you can get your book on the shelf without having to get through the librarian, but you're not going to be in the card catalog. There's a huge, undifferentiated mass of stuff that might go on thanks to the ability to put speech or music or some other kind of medium onto the net without having to go through a gatekeeper, but then it's just a big pile, people can't sort through it, and it's difficult to sell it. Let me ask either or both, writer and publisher, what would be the ideal formula for vindicating trust vis-a-vis the people that are going to pay for the work? Kevin Boyle is ready to sign on to his new trusted PC. Thanks to it, what are the kinds of transactions you're hoping the software people will enable that maybe weren't possible before? Is that a well-formed enough question?
I don't think it is for me, actually. I'm not quite sure what all that stuff means, but I know that for me, I like people to be able to see my work. You know, I like people to be able to get it quickly and be able to have it and look at it.
Do you care if people pay for it?
Yeah, and I do care if people pay for it.
I want to make sure that if they don't pay for it, they don't see it?
Well, I mean, that's sort of the way it is now, right? You know, like, well, in general, I mean, you go to a bookstore and you know, it's all the time.
And you pay before you
buy the book, and yeah, take it out of the store and you can read it.
So you can look at the book in the bookstore and not pay, right?
You can, but you know, like,
some people are known to actually read books in the bookstore.
Yeah,
but
that's really uncomfortable. Like, it's not really very fulfilling, you know? Like,
yeah.
It's just like the sort of one-time thing. And, you know,
although it's changing, you realize the Barnes & Noble is putting out comfortable chairs and a locker bar. And then, you know, it's not like you're hiding in the aisle. You're actually just going in to read.
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess that's not so bad. I mean, it's probably pretty comfortable.
Maybe Barnes & Noble is now in the latte business rather than the bookseller business.
Yeah, well, I really don't know too many people at Barnes & Noble, so I can't say that. No, we like to make sure that we get paid for what we do.
Right, so you want to get paid for what you do.
Yes.
And the current way on the internet, and I understand that you're exactly the wrong person to ask, for how you get paid for what you do is big question mark. Is that right? You don't know how you get paid.
Well, generally not really.
So maybe a publisher can help you out. She appears to be your representative in these things.
Yeah.
I just want to clear up one point. What you two are discussing about going in and browsing through a book, one of the criticisms that's being leveled against the publishers in discussions about going online, right now the technology is such that we expect that every time a book or an article is downloaded, the price that we're asking will be charged. And people are saying right now, well, the reason that that's bad is because that eliminates fair use.
Well, wait, you're going so quickly here.
I
just wanted to, this poor guy is looking so confused.
I'll clear it up for you. You asked what's the ideal software.
And yeah, exactly. What would you want?
We want the ability to price discriminate. We want the ability to charge a different amount for an online library who wants to rent books out for the afternoon versus a student, versus a senior citizen, versus an average 35-year-old working class guy. We want the ability to do what we do in real life, which is charge different amounts for different aspects.
Do you do that in real life? When I go into a bookstore and I want a John Grisham novel, am I asked who I am? Is a secret biopsy performed on my wallet so they know how much they have with me before I get the book?
No, but there are different ways to access information than a bookstore. When students go to libraries, they're allowed to make photocopies of information. I mean, it's for educational purposes, for example. And we don't charge for that. There are senior citizens book clubs who will offer books at a discount. So it's not, granted, Barnes & Noble is one venue, but that's not the only one.
All right, so there's the real world where you go to a store, you buy books. There's even a sense of alternate distribution channels in the real world, such that people can go to libraries and get them for free, but you have to go to the trouble of going to the library. So maybe people that could afford not to don't and pay the difference and get the book from a bookstore. But now the kind of price discrimination you're talking about sounds like it even goes beyond that, right? Because now Kevin Boyle could join the Book of the Month Club, answer some questions about who he is, and you could actually figure out how much to charge him versus charges someone else. Is that right?
That's what we want. We want the ability to charge. If Kevin says he just wants to browse for an afternoon, we wouldn't want to charge him the full price of that book because the way that the technology ideally would work is he would download it onto his computer. He would get it, for example, when you go to the reserve room at the library, you get free for 5 hours. He would get it on his computer and download for 5 hours, and after 5 hours, that file would come back to us. He would no longer have it on his hard drive. And he would only get paid for that 5 hour use. So he could browse.
You can rent by the hour the information. Let me just double check with the software manufacturer. You guys can do that?
Yeah, of course we can.
And the ones who are going to put it to you is AT&T. You can do that.
There isn't that much that we can't do. We're an alliance, so, the five, largest companies that have their own software manufacturers in the U.S., so, in the world, pretty much. And we actually do have some prototypes, which will do exactly what she's talking about. It's not very hard, to write up some software so that you have limited use over, certain files. It's just like, I guess you could think of it as how file access works.
The wonderful analogy from the other, it's just like file access. Yeah. That's right.
It's like file access, for a Unix machine. You have the room, and then you have the different users, and different people have different, access rights and
so tell us more about this. Assume that some of us in the room are not usual users of a Unix machine. And on the Unix machine there are files. And the files have rights associated with them. Is that what you're saying?
Right.
How do these rights work?
Well, I shouldn't say, it's not that the files have rights associated with them, it's that the users, the different users, of the machine have rights to certain files. So for example, let's say we have, file A and file B on the system, and, you might be able to access file A only, and you might not be able to access file B, and then, somebody, I guess, is supposed to think of as the administrator. Mm-hmm. Be able to assign you rights to certain files and that type of thing. So the analogy, I guess, for the publisher would be that, the publisher would be the administrator and he'd be able to say, this person, has rights to do such and such to this file for a certain period of time. And of course, you can do that.
Fascinating. This goes well beyond the real world. This is a new empowerment. A new empowerment allowing all sorts of new kinds of transactions to take place. Transactions that aren't just, here's your book, thanks for the money, God bless, but rather, you can read the book, you can't. You can have the book for 5 hours, you get it for 10, etc., etc. That's pretty good. And that's what makes you happy, and then by implication, that's what makes you happy.
Well,
This sounds like independent thought. What's going on?
Well, I guess I just don't really understand how this works. I mean, I go to a bookstore and I buy a book and I have it and I can read my book. But I mean, it's like turning a book into like writing a video or something. Is that?
Yeah, sounds like that.
It just seems very weird to me. Like, it's not like overcomplicating it or something like that. I mean, like, isn't it okay if people just go buy a book and they have it? Like, that's not good enough for.
It sounds like you just put Kevin's hat on. You've lapsed into just being a member of the general citizenry.
Well, I am, too.
A poor artist trying to make a living, well, and hearing the good news that there's a new way to do so.
Well, it's just very confusing to me, I suppose, so. I wouldn't mind if someone could clarify a little bit more. Like, how would you, like, determine, you know, like, you pay, like, $5 for, like, you know, like, 10 minutes, or, like, what if it's, like, a really famous author, you pay, like, $5 for 1 minute, like, I should read it, or?
Is that how it works this way?
We're not talking about renting books exclusively. If you wanted to own this book and have it on a hard drive forever, we would love it if you would do that, and you would just pay more to own it. So you could have it, and you could print it out, and in the future we expect that there will be electronic books where you can actually download the information onto something that resembles a real book, but it's actually keyed on a computer screen. So you can own the information. It'll just cost you a different amount to own it.
Can you transfer the information to someone else? I mean, all we have these senior citizens taking their discounts, getting the information, and then arbitraging it over to the yuppies who would be charged more if they had to get it directly from you.
Oh, I suppose that would be, are you talking about from computer to computer, for example?
Right.
My mother sends it to me.
Right.
Well, two things would happen there. If my mother sends the file to me, it's no longer on my mother's computer. So it's as if there was a real, tangible book. Only one of us can possess it.
This is thanks to the trusted software.
Right, this is, trusted software. And because we're talking about an ideal world, as a publisher, my ideal world would be that my computer would have certain identification, I don't know the correct terminology, you might have to correct me, something that identifies my computer to my mother's computer. So that if she sends the book to me, to loan it to me, my computer will then dial up to Simon & Schuster, wherever the book came from, and say, this no longer is in the possession of a senior citizen, no longer owned by a senior citizen, now it's a student, and my computer will be charged accordingly.
The differential
will be charged. This is ideally for us, the computer would recognize my information.
Kevin is a student, and perhaps someday a senior citizen. How are you reacting to this?
It allows me to do license agreements so that I can do exactly what I want with the book.
You don't get those extra words you didn't want to pay for. You only want the topic sentence of each paragraph. And you know, you want to pay for this extra stuff so that you give me the discount. I don't really read it discount.
I mean, there are some books that I don't want to keep that I don't want to pay more money to keep a book that I don't like.
This is just like the book on tape that they do for business people that don't have time to read real books. So the book on tape reads to them in compressed form 15 books on how to be a better business person in about 15 minutes, and they're only paying for the highlights.
So I could also take a 5-hour period and get more read the book and decide that I really like it and then keep it instead of being forced to buy it and it just sucks.
All right. So there's Kevin Boyle, citizen. Mr. Palfrey, you've been quiet this whole time since I haven't called you. How does this sound to you? It sounds like libraries are going to be their own category in this thing, and you'll be able to cut some deal with these Myers to get your own ability to get the information and share it out, no?
That may be, but boy, I think it sounds terrible.
Common words for a librarian.
Oh, yeah. This really gets my blood boiling. I mean, I'm no Luddite, but I think the age of information and all this internet stuff, it sounded great at first. People could have direct access to all sorts of additional information. It's been really good for libraries. We've got more kids coming in to, play on the internet and, get on the computer and do fun things than we ever had before. And sometimes they even check out a book and, this has been great, but I read these news releases or listen to these people and I hear safety and security and trust, and what I think I really, really hear is power grabbing and control in the hands of the few. And I hear price discrimination from the publisher, and I hear price gouging to the library. I think this is just a bad thing for the citizens. I think Kevin should be very upset. Congressman Brown should be up in arms. And I think it's just bad.
His poll numbers haven't come in yet.
We'll get them soon.
Okay. Ms. Meyer, Mr. Palfrey says that this is not a good deal for everybody.
I sympathize, but this is what the market is telling us works. People want this. People are willing to pay for it. If people aren't going to libraries anymore, it's because it's easier to download things off online. I apologize that we're becoming perhaps a lazy society that wants to stay home and do this all from our laptop, but I'm a businesswoman, and I respond to what the market says, and right now this is where the money is, and I'd be a fool not to take it.
But are you going to create a world in which Mr. Palfrey's customers, his clients at his library, can't borrow a book?
Books will always be out there. They'll be charming, antiques. And people will always enjoy browsing through.
So Mr. Palfrey will say, can I interest you in something pre-1950? That'll be...
There will always be people who will be interested in books, and I think, if I may be so bold as to talk to studies, I think there are studies that people right now enjoy reading things on paper, so that if they get sent an email that's longer than a page long, they'll print it out. So some people are more comfortable reading on paper than on screen, so he'll always have an audience.
That satisfy you, Mr. Palfrey?
Frankly, no. I mean, it's actually worse than I thought it was. I was publishing perhaps had a heart and were, you know, going to cut us a really nice deal after I complained really loudly. But no, I think that this points more in the direction of sort of the advent of the private library than I thought it did. And no, I think this is not good. We have to think not only about what the market is saying, but what about the public interest? What about people who may have less access to technology? What about people who actually are lifelong library users, or for them that's much more convenient? They can come and get information, books, and download stuff from us. We'll give them some discs or something.
So this is an interesting thought, but of course the future is now. Ms. Prevost is busily at work, but not on a panel, making it all happen technologically. And Ms. Meyer is giving her a list of requirements that would make for really good trusted software. What are you going to do about it? Are you actually so steamed that you're going to ask for a law?
Talking to me?
Yeah.
Wow. Absolutely. I've been contacting Congressman Brown for months now. I think.
And he hasn't returned your calls, huh?
Well, he will. And those poll numbers are looking pretty good. I think that this is an area in which public policy needs to be formed that will protect the public interest. And I do see public values in trust, and I'm a consumer. I like to buy books at Barnes & Noble or BN.com or whatever myself. And I want my credit card number secure, but I also think we need to preserve public access and control of books and things in the hands of some librarians.
So I want to ask Mr. Brown what he has to say about this. Ms. Vandertop, do you have something you want to jump in?
All books and computers, like downloading them from the internet, is that substitutable at all? I mean, if we're talking about books with 500 pages, how do you think I can understand books?
So it's the essence of your doubt that simply can't substitute. The people that usually rely on books need not worry.
I think books are here to stay, and I don't think it's the same thing as having a little file on your computer. Nobody's going to look at a screen for hours.
But what about Ms. Meyer's little e-books? I mean, is your idea eventually to kill the book?
The idea technologically is that you will say you have a 500-page contract book right now. In a perfect technological future, it'll still be 500 pages. The difference will be that instead of it being a tree that had to die for the page for every book that you want to read,
you hear the screams now.
You'll have one 500-page book, and every page will be a blank screen. It'll be a paper thin screen. You'll plug that into your computer, download information, and presto, words will appear on the screen. You'll still be turning pages. Right, exactly. And this is, we're not here yet, but that's a technological idea.
Ms. Prevost, can you do this? How many years will it take you? Infinity is also an acceptable answer here. How many years will it take you to generate this handheld book for which I would be just as comfortable as a reader, and my eyes will be just as fine reading these digital pages that Ms. Meyer is describing over reading a regular dead tree book?
Actually, there are several research groups, you know, in the country that are working on exactly this type of thing. For example, it's a pet project of Nicolas Adrofonte at the MIT Media Lab. He's working on exactly this type of thing. And it'll probably take like another, I don't know, 5 to 6 years maybe before this, you know.
Before the libraries, as we know them, have their death knell sound. All right, 5 or 6 years, that's a lot of time. Mr. Palfrey, I'm going to put this around now to Mr. Brown. Mr. Brown, Mr. Palfrey has asked for a lot. He doesn't mind what's going on. He has shared his pain. And he thinks there ought to be a lot. What do you think?
Well, I like the way things are going. I like the sound coming from the publishers and from the Trust of Concealment. On the other hand, my mother's a librarian, so I really appreciate the work you do. And also, I'm some younger.
That 85 cents will get him on the bus.
Don and I have some younger kind of idealistic staff, which tell me that this is a real problem. And so they've discussed possibly passing some kind of law to protect their uses and public interests in this kind of context.
Isn't there already a fair use right? They hear this stuff about fair use. Isn't there already fair use?
There is. It's an affirmative defense for a copyright infringement. So if someone went in and was accused of copying, say, Alden's book, they could claim that it was fair use if they were just using it to in an article or something criticizing it or for research. So it exists, sure.
So before I take our panel off their respective hot seats, is there anybody who wants to ask a question of them?
I see gentlemen that I wish we had more than one microphone. Yes.
So my question is to the artist is why do you want to pay the publisher 90% royalties for basically indexing and bringing the public your work to the public when the librarians want to do it for free? If it's going to be a digital system, why not have a digital card catalog that the librarian's going to pay for rather than having the publisher take a 90% cut off the top?
This is a microphone.
Well, that's a very good question, and it does make a lot of sense, and well, I guess I'd like to know what you have to say about that.
The cat's out of the bag, Ms. Meyer. What do you say?
I don't know how much experience you guys have in librarians, but they're usually pretty nice, and they want to show you around, but they're not really going to give you an opinion. They're not going to say, this book is a page-turner, and this book is a drag. Librarians are there to tell you how to use the Dewey Decimal System.
The New York Times Book Review will tell me that then.
So starting to sound like the names list.
I mean, the point is, I can get recommendations for free. And you're talking about how does anyone know what a good book is? People find out good books from other people by word of mouth. I mean, the thing the internet's great at is word of mouth. And there are a lot of people now putting out books on the internet just so that they can get around the publisher and get the word of mouth out there.
I agree with you that if all we're talking about is recommendations, that you can get those. And there definitely, Oprah has a book club. You can rely on Oprah. But I think that you're underestimating the volume of work that's out there and the role that we play in taking just a fraction of that and putting it actually to press. I think you have a valid argument that people don't really rely on us to say what's a good book, because Lord knows we put out some duds. But we make the amount of information manageable. I think that's what
I'm saying. So it creates a censorship for those
who ignore that.
A question here from Liz LeMay. Maybe you can orchestrate getting the mic up to her.
I am Carol LeMay. I'm the president and executive director of the North China Frontier Foundation. Question for you guys, particularly from the publishers community and the industry, which is if the internet allows everyone to be a publisher or a journalist, then doesn't fair use work for all of them? And doesn't even rules then, which lock down their information and make them identify themselves as a journalist, become moot if everyone's a journalist? How do you think about that?
Anyone
addressing
the question
again?
I'm not sure I'm just
Okay. So when you talk about, when you talk about these trusted systems or user rules-based systems, systems where you identify yourself as something for a particular period of time to do certain information, which is one, a privacy violation to some degree. And then the second issue...
Is it a privacy violation if somebody asks me if I am a student and will give me a discount if so, and I then tell them and they give me the discount? That's a privacy violation?
It may or may not be depending on how the company implements it and what they're tracking when you're doing this. And if they're tracking all of your relationships across line, including the music you're listening to and the text that you're reading, it could conceivably be a violation in a number of areas. But the net, and the critical piece of the net, is that it allows everyone to be a journalist and a publisher and a scientist and or a student.
But some scientists will still be better than others, right?
It doesn't matter if they're better or not.
It just means
that they can. Therefore, if everyone in the whole population identifies themselves as a journalist, which means you need to be able to always give them full and complete access for using quotations in different pieces of articles or things they would post as a student in a school or an article they're going to put on their own home page, how do you respond to that?
I don't want to see the hot potatoes.
So does this mean that I don't have to give so much money to publishers? Like, I can just do this myself?
Yeah. You absolutely could if you chose to, depending on what kind of economic model you wanted to use. I mean, you might choose to sell ads along with it as a way of supporting it instead of supporting your publisher for doing it. But if you're going to assume that everyone needs to be able to download it for free so that they can be a producer of content and participate as a journalist and a contributor online to the growth of human intellectual content, then a user rules-based system that locks out everyone as being a journalist really shuts down the innovation and the freedom that copyright law allows for. So you might be able to participate in a different kind of a way.
So you should mull that over. While we see we have five comments to the system, why don't we solve from these and then we're going to refocus with the lecture. What do we have? Are the people stupid enough to need a publisher to filter literature for them? They are not real arts critiques. They are just following their economic interests. Apologize to the publisher for the sort of edge to that comment. But, any reaction to that?
Again, I'm just going to fall back on the market argument. We're publishing the works that sell and that do well. I apologize if I represented us as the filter, that our job was primarily one to filter quality, but I admitted we turn out some schlocky stuff. But I really think that as business people, we're marketing what sells, and we haven't been wrong. We haven't been wrong so far. We haven't been losing business.
So the second question asks about some constitutional principles that might want to trump economic ones. We will turn to that momentarily. The third one says, as a librarian, Glenn, don't you see a tremendous opportunity to serve those who don't have access to technology or private libraries and public resources? Are you afraid of the competition from the ever more present bookstore? I think poor Glenn only has a mom who is a librarian. Mr. Palfrey is the librarian today.
I think it's a good question, and in fact, I think it sets up the point that this could be great for libraries. It would be wonderful if we were able to have a meaningful role in all of this. I'm just really worried that the sort of approach that Ms. Meyer and her colleagues are taking to this may be to look out for economic interests first and then sort of think about librarians and libraries and the public interest second. So, and then the competition for the ever more present bookstore, not really. I think, more books the better, and if people want to pay for it, that's great, but, as long as we can still make available to people in a free and easy way the information, then I'm happy.
Okay, finally, Ms. Ortega asks, how are you going to pay for the books online? How the security actually works both ways? How is it that the customer can trust that the information on the credit card is stolen, and how can the publishers trust that the book online won't be recopied? How does that all work, Ms. Carlos? In a nutshell.
In a nutshell, well, today most of the backend security is provided by encryption. By, for example, you know, RSA encryption or IDIC encryption, and that type of thing, which ensures that whatever information that you transmit, you know, to whoever you're trying to buy from, is in a format, it is garbled pretty much, so that you know, keep drawing it up.
So I have right now an email client, call it Eudora. Somebody sends me something in Eudora, I can forward it on to someone else. Doesn't cost me anything except hitting the F key and waiting a second when the bar fills up and off it goes again, and I've kept my copy as well. Are you saying that there's such a thing as a trusted Eudora client that behaves differently?
You're asking whether, for example, if you were to forward a copy of your email to somebody else, then the copy that you have would no longer be on your machine.
Yeah, because Ms. Meyer was talking with pie in the sky stuff about how if I send someone else, it vanishes off of my machine as if I've handed it over. Or maybe I just wouldn't be allowed to forward on it. Is that possible?
It is. And what we're trying to do in the strategic alliance, for example, is embed that type of security functionality into the hardware so that
So security functionality secures the hardware against me. I'm the user of the computer, and it's securing it against my attempts to do something different than I'm supposed to do. Is that right?
Well, yeah. If you're not supposed to be allowed to do it, if that's what the contact is with you, and the content of the email or whatever, if that's what it's supposed to be.
So somebody could send me an email. Today, I get an email that says, "By the way, don't give this to anyone. This is just for you. Do not redistribute." And I say, "You're right, I keep a secret, only me and my 20 closest friends." And I send it on. But you're saying there would be a way to tag that email that says, "No, I really mean it. Don't copy it." And regardless of my indiscretion, the email software won't let me forward. All right, so that's answering the question. All right, so why don't we're going to return to the broader discussion, but let me first just help frame things with a few thoughts. And I want to start by just talking about the framers. Now, already we're looking at a U.S.-centric view, the framers of the U.S. Constitution. Interestingly, in this area, the area of copyright and intellectual property, there is a lot of harmony from one nation to the next. There's a whole set of cascading agreements, international treaties, that actually obligate us as the United States to hew to certain copyright restrictions to keep us in harmony with the rest of the world. And indeed, often when these are copyright bills talked about in the U.S. Congress or elsewhere, it will be this kind of leapfrog purpose of keeping in harmony with everybody else. So here's from the U.S. Constitution. Among the enumeration of powers to Congress is this one. Congress may promote the progress of the science of sciences and the useful arts, comma, and there's a typo in the Constitution, I don't see my copy, by securing for limited time to authors and inventors the exclusive rights to their respective writings and discoveries. This is called the Copyright Clause. And in the U.S. system, it's what is thought to empower the Congress explicitly to pass laws about copyright, patents, perhaps trademark, and even trade secrets. Now, the interesting thing is about this clause. It has that aspect of the Second Amendment where it offers up its justification in a comma beforehand to promote the progress of the sciences and the useful arts. So it's saying, here's why you have the power, Congress. Question, if Congress were to use the power it's given in a way that does not, in whose judgment, I don't know, maybe a court, promote the progress of the sciences and the useful arts, would that be unconstitutional? Good question. Also notice it says by securing for limited times. Now we have the benefit of a lot of correspondence among the framers on this. Jefferson in particular didn't like monopolies, period. This was an era in which monopolies were given by the king on anything. You could be the only shoemaker in this town. And particularly monopolies on speech. Now Jefferson, in a quotation offered at the beginning of the Barlow article you all read, says how he believes that ideas are inherently free. You can give them away, and they don't disappear from you as you share them with someone else. And it was actually that belief that led him to be less worried than he might have otherwise been about the inclusion of this clause in the Constitution. Because Jefferson's worry had been, wait a minute, why are we giving these authors monopolies on their work? Isn't that against free speech? Because how else do you give somebody a monopoly on speech but by saying anybody else who utters the identical words is acting contrary to the law? So limited times crept in there. Limited times was the idea of Congress can't make this last forever. So that the bounty that's created when artists and investors do their thing can be incorporated further into new works, you only have it happen for a limited time. That original limited time was 12 years, and as we've discussed in other classes, it's now up to 95 years before the work enters the public domain. There's no longer any copyright protection on it. Okay, so copyright, how does that work? First, it's important to know the scope. And the most important thing to know about the scope is first the idea expressed in the first section of the Copyright Code, Title 17, that there's a difference between an idea and the expression of the idea. Now that may seem an odd distinction. What is the difference between an idea and the expression of an idea? Well, the best way that the Copyright Act tries to cover it, at least the most explicit, is by saying it only applies to things that are fixed in a tangible medium. Only when the words are actually written down or captured on photoelectric tape or something does copyright actually apply. So if I go out and I just say things into the air and someone repeats them, copyright doesn't apply to it. But even beyond that idea, expression distinction is the idea that if they were to paraphrase what I said, if I had a particularly good idea there, one of our panelists had a particularly good idea, and you went out and told people about that, you wouldn't be violating copyright if you didn't use the exact words they used to express it. Now, if you drop out articles and leave all the rest of the words in the order they were offered, that might be cheating. If you put it in pig Latin, that might be cheating. And you can imagine, there's all sorts of case law that define what's cheating and what's not in this area. But that's at least one thing to worry about. In the context, actually, of Harvard University, there is a recent flap. I saw it in the Mather Matters newsletter. Have I told you guys about this yet? The Mather Matters newsletter had an admonition recently that said, don't sell your notes. Harvard students are reminded to think about page 345 of the student handbook. I can imagine they've already read it. And in that, it said that anybody who sells his or her own notes from a Harvard lecture shall be asked possibly to withdraw from the college. Interesting. Now, is that assertion of copyright? Is this right on this point?
It is.
Go ahead, Amy.
I'm a doctor at Harvard College, uh-huh. So I have come up with this issue. And the main concern of the college are the internet websites that like
Versity.com.
Where they hire undergraduate students and they pay them something like $10 an hour to take their course notes, put them in a certain format, and then post them to the web.
So here's Versity.com.
lecture notes.
Lecture notes, up on the upper left there, or right there, yeah. Select the state of the school. All right. Let's pick Massachusetts. Please select the school. All right. There's Harvard University. If this class is here, I'm going to be very angry. And there are some classes. All right. So let's pick one. Now, how did... So click on something. We click. It's just waiting. Now, do you know how much a student might get paid by?
The student gets paid $10 an hour. I'm not sure exactly how they keep their time because the student I know who was involved in this had to sign a non-disclosure agreement. About not disclosing any information about Versity.com and how they're doing this.
And how did you get involved with this student?
I got involved in this because the student came to me and said, I signed up to work for Versity.com. They told us it was all cool with Harvard. the professors might not like it a little bit, but that it didn't violate any policy. I talked to my dad, he thought it sounded weird, and so I should ask you. And so I then inquired of the dean of freshmen, who's my boss, who said, under no uncertain circumstances are they to participate with diversity.
That's page 345 of the handbook.
Right, and also students who go to the web page and don't work for them, but either purchase them or download them for free are also violating Harvard's code because it's academic dishonesty, according to the Ad Board of Harvard College.
Academic dishonesty, yeah.
I think it's not following this point. Admittedly, you might say that there's a law and there's a forum, statements that suggest this, but isn't the value of these notes in the possibility of actually going to the lecture, isn't that way going to be a difference? When you can download them and do something completely different than actually being able to listen to the professor, going to the university, living the life.
It's definitely different. You're assuming that the worry that Harvard has about this whole thing is that their valuable intellectual property is being stolen. Is that the worry you think that animates page 345 of the manual? But I hear it's academic dishonesty. You think it's that or fear of the fruits of the class being shared?
Why would it be academic dishonesty if I go to the top and discuss it with people? Is that fine?
So what happened? The students had to retract to
their
notes?
The students revoked their contract to stateuniversity.com for fear of going to
the
Ad Board and
facing
suspension from school.
Now, do we think, I hate to cold call you, from what I told you so far, do you think that a copyright interest could be asserted by the college or by the professor against the notes that the student took?
I think that's what's driving them, at least on that point of the debate. As it was explained to me by the dean, Harvard is concerned that basically the students are running a business out of their room, is how they put it to me, and that they are capitalizing on Harvard's property.
So if a student were simply to take notes and put them up and say, here world, here's what I'm learning, would that be contrary to the handbook?
If it was on the internet, I'd say probably yes. I think it's an issue of publication as far as the university is concerned.
All right. So I want us to bookmark this issue. I know there's a lot of ferment about this. Bookmark this issue of the Mather Matters newsletter, and we'll see if the site ever actually gives us some lecture notes, and we wanted to see what they were like after we go. Okay, so that's one thing. Now, my own answer to this question is I doubt even the person giving the lecture, the author of the words, would be able to assert copyright interest in notes taken about what was said. I mean, at the base, what is the idea of going to school in large part, but learning a bunch of stuff, and then going out and making use of it later, which might even entail repeating parts of what you learned to other people who weren't there at the time. Now, that is sharing ideas. That's sort of what's supposed to happen, at least the way the framers may have been conceiving of the copyright and the people who wrote later iterations of the copyright statute. Now, of course, copyright isn't the whole story here. Even if it weren't violative of copyright to make these notes, there may be other schemes by which it can be prevented, including what essentially a private law scheme says that may well be information you are entitled under the law to do, but Harvard has its own policy, and we're entitled to kick you out, and you can take your pick. Okay, another thing to know about Scope is the Feist debate. I don't know how much I've talked about the Feist case, or if the MIT students have heard about Feist yet. Okay. One thing expressed in the copyright law is the idea that creative expression is what's protected. This was put to the test in a case called Feist, in which somebody had gone to trouble compiling a phone book, a white pages. Somebody else went to much less trouble to copy the whole thing and make another one and sell it under a different name, stealing the original person's work. And Feist was the case that was resulted. Went up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court said, yes, I understand that your brow sweated profusely to put together this original white pages. You actually have to put an effort to it. However, the copyright statute does not cover what you did, because it's not sufficiently original. It's just a collection of facts. and collections of facts don't count for copyright. So you'll hear this talked about in categories of database protection. How do you take collections of facts, perhaps stock ticker information, sports scores? There was a recent case about sports scores. Motorola was offering a beeper service where you could get beeps and know exactly what the NBA score was as the game unfolded. And the complaint was that's stealing from the NBA. There are people hard at work, their brows are sweating, generating those scores on the court. How dare Motorola take them and deliver them to people that didn't pay for tickets or go through television rights, which are also negotiated to get them. But in that case, they didn't use copyright because they couldn't. They knew better. Instead, they went for state law misappropriation. They opened the court's toolbox to try to get something there. So the price debate started, or the focus of it, the idea of copyright only protecting creative expression, not facts, even though it may promote the progress of the collection and distribution of facts to have some form of monopoly in the person who goes to the couple of doing it, just like copyright is thought to do it as well. Okay, so once you know some sense of what is protected by copyright, you also want to ask, what does the protection entail? We know of rights as a bundle of sticks. It is a lot of people on that, it's a property. All right, so what are some of the sticks in the bundle? So I actually am playing chapter and verse here from Section 106 of the Copyright Act, which says, except for certain exceptions, here are a number of things that if you are the copyright holder, you can assert. For instance, you have the right to reproduce the copyrighted work in copies or photo records. Okay, aside from thinking strange that photo records actually appears in the United States Code, that's the most obvious of the copyright. It's literally the right to copy. Here's another, to prepare derivative works based upon the copyrighted work. What is preparing derivative work? A derivative work is something that incorporates in large part that which came before, quite literally. So one example might be if you were to take a book and then write a new introduction to it and publish the whole work and say it's a different work. It's not just a copy. It has a new introduction. Or perhaps you were to translate it from English to French. You say, I haven't copied the words. I paraphrased it in a different language. No, it turns out you've produced a derivative work. So that's one of the rights. Now, interestingly, to produce a derivative work, you may not even have to make a copy. That's right number one. Right number two is just derivative work. So in a very odd case, for example, somebody who took a picture, placed it into a ceramic tile, and then sought to sell the tile was accused of making a derivative work. You don't actually own the object to the point of being able to create a new object with it. I don't know how this would apply, for instance, to ransom notes. Somebody were to cut up a bunch of magazines and make a collage and sell it. Among other things you'd be in trouble for might be the production of a derivative work from all of the copyright holders from whom you drew to make your note. Nothing. None is how you can remember derivative works. To distribute copies or photo records of the copyrighted work to the public by sale or other transfer of ownership or by rental, lease, or lending. So this means I have the right of first publication. The copyright holder, I can take this thing and sell it. Nobody else can do that, including by lending. They don't have the right to lend out my thing. Now this sounds fairly obvious if you think about intellectual property as real property, which it isn't, as resembles. But there's an important exception to this, which we'll get to and which actually bears on this segment. And there are a whole bunch of other rights as well that have to do with performance of music, etc., that I won't trouble you with right now, but you can check Section 106 to get the whole story. Right, so in addition to these rights, these are rights given to the holder of the copyright, the author or perhaps the publisher, because one thing you can do is transfer your rights. They're eminently alienable. So I can take, if I'm the author here, and I don't know what's going on, I hand a contract, I sign at the bottom, and suddenly Jessica holds the copyright to all the work that he creates, and then can make most of it under some arrangement, should be 10% of what is done. Now, here are defenses to infringement. Somebody says, wait a minute, I had those rights, and you violated them. They can take you to court for a civil, in a civil proceeding, the damages, etc. If it wasn't enough, there can be criminal copyright infringement. And here are some defenses you can raise. So here's an example. Fair use. Fair use. Now, fair use is elusive. hard to describe without this entire paragraph. The fair use of a copyrighted work, including such use by reproduction in copies or photo records or by any other means specified by that section, for purposes such as criticism, comment, news reporting, etc., is not an infringement of copyright. And to help guide you, they come up with four principles that are supposed to help you figure out what is or isn't fair use. Now, in practice, this can be a bit of a problem, because if somebody hits you, if Ms. Meyer gets her lawyers to hit you for copyright infringement, for having dared to copy one of her works, you may have an affirmative defense, but you've actually got to sit through the whole first part of the case before you can bring it. It's reminiscent of SysOptim, where the actual workings of the law, which are designed to help sort out whose right belongs to whom, can themselves help gain the outcome of the case. So your lawyer might say to you, yes, it looks to me like fair use, but, you know, I can't be sure, and it'll cost you approximately $500,000 to find out the hard way, at which point you still may lose, but I'm at your disposal should you want to carry on the case. In that instance, you may find yourself opting to recede from whatever activity is being claimed that you are doing to violate copyright rather than fight it out. And this is part of the reason why the Kinko's employee will look at you stone-facedly even as you say, but wait a minute, it's just fair use. I'm only Xeroxing one page out of this book. Kinko's employee will say, I'm sorry, tell the judge, and not allow you to copy the work in question. All right, so what's the point here? What is this law doing? And another defense, which I should mention before we come to this, is what's known as the first sale doctrine. The law provides that if you sell something, you transfer ownership of a copy of a book, you can't then assert control over what happens next. This is very important to people like Mr. Palfrey, because what it means is that if a library buys a book from a publisher, it is now entitled to lend that book out to people. You might think of that as an obvious thing, but it's only there because it's specifically provided for in the Copyright Act. And indeed, for some other media, as Howard and I were just discussing earlier, it actually has some dicey exceptions. Computer software is not allowed to be lended in this fashion, in many cases, by somebody other than a library. All right, so what's the law doing here? It's giving rights to authors and publishers. It's giving privileges to readers and consumers. You have the plaintiff's claim, and then the defendant raises a defense. And the idea, hopefully, is that in passing the law the way Congress did, it was balancing certain interests at stake. This isn't any old property we're talking about. This is ideas and speech. And there's even a suggestion that if Congress had neglected the past, for instance, the fair use defense, that would be unconstitutional. It would be an abridgment of speech violative of the First Amendment had you allowed copyright to be so strong as to not even allow fair use. Congress doesn't have that power. Now, that hasn't been tested because there is fair use, but you get the idea of Congress juggling multiple interests here, remuneration for the author and the free flow of ideas captured in something like fair use or the first sale doctrine. They're trying to, you know, come up with a happy medium, as they are paid to do. All right, so now let me just tell a quick story. Story of Internet 1994. It's very different from the story we heard today, so wonderfully put together by the panel, as to the Internet that is just around the corner. This is from the LA Times, which is Double Trouble. It says, with silicon microchips, an exact electronic replica can be made of virtually any medium, images, sound, or data. February cover of Scientific American magazine, for instance, featured a digitally altered photograph that shows Marilyn Monroe flirting with Abraham Lincoln. Not clear to me, a pair of scissors couldn't do the same thing. But and then there's another example. It says, armed with personal computers and digital recorders, entrepreneurs around the globe are using digital technology in more foreboding ways. They are making unauthorized copies of billions of dollars worth of music, movie, software, pharmaceutical formulas. How many people in here, you can admit it, have copied a pharmaceutical formula usually on the internet and other so-called intellectual property. And thanks to the growing matrix of global computer networks, they can zap the appropriate works to consumers around the world in seconds. This is a disaster. This is from the rest of the LA Times. Technological feats are testing the effectiveness of the U.S. patent, trade secret, and copyright laws. And this spread is quickly eroding the political and geographic boundaries that allow industry and governments to maintain control over information through legal measures. Here's from the New York Times, themes in the idea marketplace. With the computer serving as the world's biggest copier, swiftly replicating not only text, but also paintings, video, and music, for manipulation of new works, how, they ask, can the original creators and owners be protected and compensated? According to leading figures in the arts and humanities, technology is fast outracing the law, and the unauthorized copying, etc., are disrupting licensing structures that date to the founding of the American Republic. And of course, you read one of the leading figures in the arts and humanities saying exactly this in the first reading of the assignment if you're a law student. I think you also had it in the first reading during my teacher, Barlow, who's the economy of ideas. And here for the Christian Science Monitor, who pays for what on tomorrow's internet? It's a thought that strikes terror in the hearts of entrepreneurs. What if their visions of online commerce turn out to be a mirage? What if all the information they hope to sell on the so-called information highway is free? Now, of course, there's a number of entrepreneurs that don't appear to be that covered by it. But here they say the threat is real enough that publishers, technologists, and legal scholars have begun a raucous debate how to protect copyrights in cyberspace. And, of course, coming up only a year later are the lawyers and legal scholars. This from a note on the Board of International Law Journal. Telecommunications, footnote, and the information superhighway, footnote, facilitate instantaneous mobility of literary and artistic works in the form of text, video, and audio recordings, footnote. With a click of a mouse or the tap of a key, virtually anyone with a computer and telephone can obtain vast quantities of information from almost anywhere on the globe, footnote. These conditions pose a formidable challenge to the international protection of intellectual property. It's so interesting because you think it's going one way. Wow, what a wonderful world. And then there's the kicker. This is a real challenge, which indeed it would seem to be. Also notice that the last thing isn't a footnote, it is a star page. What is the star page? The star page means, now it can be revealed, I got this from Westlaw. Westlaw does helpful star pages. It tells you that it's at 18, Fordham International Law Journal 1258, but that's where the page turns over to 1259. The lawyers, you know, that this is helpful for citation. I can point to the exact page, and I don't actually have to have the thing in front of me, thanks to the Westlaw star paging. Westlaw asserted copyright in star paging. Westlaw said, guess what? This work is now copyrighted by Westlaw, as well as by whomever we contracted with to put it up there, like the Board of International Law Journal. So if you are, for instance, you think of the law, right, because you can also get the law, copyright things that I put up there, Section 106 from Westlaw. Now, by law, American law is not protected by copyright. Nobody can take it. It's our law, after all, and there's no such thing as proprietary code, so it's open code. The problem is that Westlaw says, guess what, we start page the law, too. So we assert a copyright in that law. So if you copy the law from our source, you are violating our copyright. In a recent decision in which perhaps many judges would have to accuse themselves, since they rely on Westlaw so much themselves, they found that that was not a good argument. Another argument that Westlaw had raised was that they correct typos in the law. And you don't know where the corrected typos are, because if they change it, they guess what, I'll take out the star paging. I don't need it, thank you very much. Now it's not copyrighted, but they say, yes, it can be fine for typos. So I think that was also found not to be protected by copyright. All right, now we come to Barlow, and this is from our readings. Legal efforts to keep the old boat floating are taking three forms. A frenzy of deck chair rearrangements, stern warnings to the passengers that if she goes down, they will face harsh criminal penalties, and serene, glassy-eyed denial. Intellectual property law cannot be patched, retrofitted, or expanded to contain digitized expression any more than real estate law might be revised to cover the allocation of broadcasting spectrum. So you will need to develop an entirely new set of methods as to fit this entirely new set of circumstances. Here's an answer to Barlow that appeared shortly after in Lawyers Weekly. This is what the lawyers had to say. Since I read a column on intellectual property, my attention was naturally caught by the words, "Everything you know about intellectual property is wrong," on the cover of a March issue of Wired magazine. The full title of the article is "The Economy of Ideas, a Framework for Rethinking Patents and Copyright" by John Perry Barlow, who is, according to a short blurb accompanying the article, the lyricist for the Grateful Dead. The thesis of the article, as far as I can make out, is that copyright and patent laws are outmoded because they're based on physical and bias ideas and they're meaningless in this high-tech age. In the end, I concluded only that Mr. Barlow must have consumed more than his share of written promises by writing all this paper. I see, towards Internet 2000. So where are we going from here? We have Barlow as one of the eminences of the age. Perhaps at some point he can correct me if I am mischaracterizing his argument at the time. You all had the benefit to read it yourself. But saying, yeah, I agree that this is posing all sorts of problems for copyright. I just celebrate it rather than worry about it. And I even assure people like Ms. Meyer, the publisher, that you should celebrate it too. You've just got to get with the program. And the panic said there are all sorts of ways to make money online that don't need copyright to be invoked in order to profit from your works. The old framers' formula of you got to be remunerated to be going to the trouble of making the work no longer applies in the digital age. There are new ways to make money, so just forget copyright. Don't even try to enforce it. All right, now for the Internet 2000, and it starts getting towards what the panel was talking about today. Step one towards Internet 2000 is going from copyright to contract. There might be ways in which what copyright doesn't cover, contract can. So hence you have a return of Feist. Feist returned a case called Pro-CD v. Zeidenberg. The Pro-CD case, in a wonderful kind of ironic twist, had somebody taking the data that Feist had gotten on the web pages, putting it on a CD-ROM, thanks to Feist, this is now allowed, because it's not copyrightable stuff, sells the CD-ROM, somebody takes the CD-ROM and says, I'm going to put this on the net. And you have a little web form so people can type in the name and get the number. Then people don't need to buy the CD-ROM, they can just come to my website. All right, so the pro-CD people that made the CD-ROM say, that's terrible, you're stealing from us, having just stolen some Feist, and they go after them. Now they know they can't go after them for copyright infringement, that's Feist. So what do they go after them for? Contract infringement. And it's not really such a thing as contract infringement, it's breach of contract. But what's the breach of contract? Well, when the guy that the Robin Hood put this stuff onto the internet opened up the package containing the CD-ROM, he probably failed to read the fine print that was on it and said, by opening the package and separating that gummy thing from the other thing, you are agreeing to the following terms and conditions, which are there inside the toaster warranty. And what the condition includes, but I promise not to redistribute this stuff. So why isn't that a valid contract? I mean, that's what trade secret is, right? Trade secret might be, here's a pharmaceutical formula. It's not protected by copyright, but you agree not to divulge it. This is the NDA. And if you violate the NDA, you go to jail, or, you know, there's a trade secret law that covers that. But also, you're in breach of the contract, and you owe us damages or something. And indeed, the Seventh Circuit said that's exactly what happened. Even though the stuff isn't protected by copyright, the contract that the guy agreed to by opening up the wrapper, binds him to his terms, which at least are reasonable enough, count, and that term included not putting it on to the internet. You'll see now a category of stuff called cryptograph agreements that are just like this, except you don't have to open the package anymore. You go to a website, you say, I agree to a very boring box of text, to that contract that binds you. When you all signed up for Westlaw, the law students among you, to get Westlaw for free, you were told you are not allowed to redistribute this, right? For educational use only. So if your dad calls you and asks for a copy of a case or something, you might not violate copyright, even if the start date is. It wouldn't violate the contract with Westlaw. So you have this movement to protect the contract that you couldn't with copyright. And thanks to the fact that pretty much anybody surfing the web can be asked to click I agree, you have a much greater ability as a publisher to try to enter into a whole bunch of new contracts. It's not like a bookstore where you get into the bookstore, it's hard to get into a contract if person buys the book, unless they're somehow opening the package themselves. The internet provides a way maybe to have more contracts take place. Now UCC2B is a uniform commercial code, because contracts are primarily state law, with an idea to actually make it clear that such agreements were generally binding. And even if they contain fairly surprising terms, you're bound to them. That did not actually go through, and is coming back to life as something called UCITA, which might be using the paper topic for later in the term. But contract is just a way station. Contract is only one way the publisher might say, all right, I don't need copyright. The other is to redefine rights. As we heard from our tech panelists, despite not having gone to law school, uses the word rights quite easily. They talk about Unix access rights. These are not legal rights. Somebody realized that rights are being used two ways. There's the right used the law school way, which means legally protected interests, and there's the right used the MIT way, which means you can't have it. And so long as in the MIT way you can't have it, the person has denied you the right to have it. Mike makes right. Now, that is something that is fairly agreed upon. Right? Trade secret is a way that so long as you can keep a secret and you hide it, even if it's not protected by copyright, no one has a right to take it from you. And you could see that, I'm using rights now very confusingly, expressed as in they have no legal right to do it. It also may mean they simply can't do it. So when you hear of all these rights management systems, the Mark Stefik article, which we've come to read, that's talking about rights in the non-legal sense. Simple constraint, raw power that prevents you from doing one thing or another. And that's how you can say, under certain versions of trusted systems, you do not have the right to fair use. There's no ability to have fair use, therefore that's not a right according to you. And, as Glenn was getting at, when he was talking about defenses to copyright infringement, fair use is merely a defense, merely a privilege. You can't go to somebody to have a book and say, I want the book. You know, I don't want to give it to you. They say, well, I only want three words, and I'm entitled to those under fair use. And they say, no, you're not. And in fact, you're not. You're only entitled to them if you can get your hands on them. And then if they come after you for copyright infringement, then you can say, ah, fair use. So you have this odd situation where the law lets people figure out who can get their hands on what. It's just a race of power. And then ratify some of the power relationships by according legal rights. So now we're imagining, yeah, answer one of the publishers was, deal with it. Copyright is dead. You can't control information, but that's okay because there are other ways to make money. Answer number two to the people who are publishers, and one that they may find more palatable, I'll respect Mr. Barlow, is, guess what? You can protect this information far more tightly and you don't need copyright to do it. The trusted PC platform is what's going to make it. And you can put your stuff out on the web and you can make it harder to copy than if you had put it out in a book. And fair use has no place in it. So I wanted to actually turn to this hypothetical. The first, you may wonder what Barlow has to say about all this, and I actually see he has entered the room. So John Perry, you have I properly represented your view here?
You represented part of it, even though you've got articles.
We should give you a microphone.
Things have changed. But, you know, it's been interesting listening to this discussion in this panel because, you know, this is all fairly classical tech chair, really. I felt like you were, it's not unfamiliar to me. I have the same kinds of discussions with publishers and they're lacking in the artistic community all the time, where I feel like they're batting, you know, hallucinatory objects and not getting down to the real issue, which is to promote the progress of the sciences and the useful arts. And I thought it was especially appropriate to make reference to the Second Amendment, because there you have this clause that precedes what is now increasingly an odd conclusion. And in this case, you have a clause that precedes what is now increasingly another odd conclusion. If you actually want to promote progress in science and useful arts, it may well be that defending the rights of those people who are necessary to distribute information under the old media is precisely the wrong way to go about it. And I think it's probably really important for us, rather than have discussions about any of the things that have piled themselves on in the effort to fix something that makes less and less sense, on a practical level, this is probably a good time for us to return to initial principles and think about, all right, how are you going to go about making people, incentivizing people to create? And how are you going to go about making those creations as widely distributed as possible? And how are you going to make those creations not only distributed, but the compost for other work, for which they always are, speaking, you know, as an artist. I can't imagine myself writing a song if I hadn't ever heard a song before, to state the most obvious case. But I also can't imagine myself writing a song that didn't in some way rip off practically every other song that had ever been written. And the more songs and more kinds of music that are available, the richer the ecosystem I have to choose from for more creation. But what we're doing now, and doing even more vigorously at the moment, I mean, Congress is fast and truly hideous legislation, and the scientific community is coming up with some truly hideous bits of software, most of them, fortunately, incompetent, but, you know, hideous in their intent. I mean, your imaginings of what programs can do at this point, I think, are fairly slender. But nevertheless, we're trying to protect a system that does not fulfill the requirements of that initial cause. And we ought to be thinking very hard about how to do that. And that's, you know, more than anything else, that's how my thinking has developed since. And also, I think that it becomes important to start thinking about matters of how the artist, him or herself, has some capacity to exercise control, not necessarily commercial, but artistic, over the work. The first order of business is to wrest ownership away from the publishers who have no right to it in the first place, given the fact that they now offer no valuable service that I can find. The next order of business is how to make certain that the artist is in a position to mediate the flow of his or her work to the audience in a fashion that is both rational economically and appropriate in terms of how they may wish to see that work altered or not altered. I don't think these are easy questions to solve at the moment. There is one other point that I think is important to bring to bear right now, which is that I genuinely consider that the greatest single threat to freedom of expression at the moment is the application of copyright law on a global basis, because that is the one, thanks to the Berne Convention, that is the one area where people can limit freedom of expression globally rather than locally. And it is being used as such. It's already been used somewhat successfully in this way by the Church of Scientology. A lot of other people will use it in this way. And so if you care about freedom of expression, especially with the strong desire on the part of publishers to save themselves by eliminating fair use, either legally or technologically, then I think you have a strong incentive to try to come up with other methods of achieving those characteristics that are contained in that first important clause.
Okay, so you want to stick around, right? I'm here for a while.
Good.
Before putting the rest of the pieces together, I want to walk through a hypothetical that lots of you should be familiar with, and I do seem to be new to this. Here's my hypothetical. Lifetime instructs copies of the popular Lifetime magazine CD-ROMs. They had a huge selection of celebrity photos and interviews. Readers who use the CDs in their computers find that they can sample, they can get access to. Three such interviews selected from a list. And after you look at three, the program says, here's who you call to get to the rest of them. And that's who you have to pay to get to the rest of them. And after payment is verified, the caller is given an unlock code that lets the CD-ROM get you to the rest of the interviews. J.O. buys a copy of Lifetime, uses the CD, thanks to undergraduate work in computer science, and Chip Scarman's proposed as a photo session here, cracks the CD protection scheme and views all 2,000 interviews
in her ledger without paying for a single one. Should the law penalize Jane in any way for what she did? Now, one question might be, now that we've walked through some doctrines, does the law penalize Jane in any way for what she did? From what you know of the law, is it going to reach her behavior? Yes? We haven't confirmed that yet. From what you've learned so far, only in this class of the law, not being an outside expert who studies this for a living, does the law reach her behavior? Yes? All right, so one thing would be, is there a contract? Right, you might think the copyright is the first error you're going to go after, but all right, let's go after contracts. Is there a contract? And I don't know. Would you buy, as the magazine said, by opening this magazine and allowing the CD to fall on your lap, you are agreeing that you will not try to hack it? I mean, if it said that on the back of the magazine or a cigarette ad you need to know, would that be enough for you?
For me personally?
Yeah.
I don't think I find a magazine anyway, so. I think I probably wouldn't bother to read the terms of this. And in that case, it might end up being interpreted a lot as a contract negotiation because the legal person wouldn't bother to read the time and the terms of the debt. And here are 65 things you can't do.
And what happens if it's a contract negotiation?
Well, you're more likely to, I guess, defeat the lifetime lawyer if they go after you for contract. For
breach of
contract, which
is unlikely
anyway,
because
you're only
one single
consumer.
Just ripping off the keyword.
Yeah.
Yeah, so my thesis is, of course, a contract of adhesion is one that you don't generally read. It's what you get in the rental car place when you rent a car. And they hand you along with the keys, a tag on the key that says, by the way, please visit our website and check out the contract. And you don't really have a chance to read it, or it's on the back of the folder or something. Now, those contracts aren't invalid. A large number of people come out of contracts by thinking that contracts with adhesion aren't valid. You do not call it that bad. It means, though, that there's a certain skepticism expressed about them by the court, and any ambiguities in them get construed against the person that wrote them rather than the person that didn't read them. So you're right. This would be an adhesive contract, but it might be one that's quite clear in its terms. And under pro CD, we might think that there'd be a contract action against the person for having hacked the CD. Yeah, Chris? Yeah, you're wondering what the argument was that the expert who said it's illegal, so you already know the answer to this. Yeah. We will get to that. That's the last piece of the trap is straight. Yeah.
Does it matter if she, if life appears not on the back of the magazine, but maybe inside, would it matter at what point she gets a chance to choose whether or not to open it or not? I mean, if she has to get it home because maybe it's in a shrink wrap bag, and you know, the whole magazine's inside her shrink wrap bag, and so she purchases it and then takes it home, then is that an undue burden on her if she chooses not to sit the license to walk all the way back to downtown News and Harvard Square and say, no, I want my money back, and maybe she gets it, maybe she doesn't?
Several star pages worth of Pro CD talked about just this. It turned out the entire license wasn't on the back of the package. It was only after you opened it. You don't open it in the store. Now I'm like, gosh, crap, they hand it back. See, I'll go check the next box and see if that's any better. So you're right. Interestingly, the Pro CD court said, you know, so long as you can return the thing and get a refund, you're not bound by the license agreement. Now, there was actually an interesting story about the Microsoft license agreement. There's this issue of Microsoft and bundling we talked about. People would find they got the computer and it came with Microsoft, Windows on it, and there's a license agreement. They say, you know what, I don't like this license agreement. I'm going to get it back. I don't agree to it. I want to keep the computer though. That's how I get a computer without Windows on it. And they would contact the manufacturer and say, I want a refund. And the manufacturer says, I can't give you a refund for your Microsoft piece of the computer. Either give us the whole computer back or not at all. He said, that's not what the contract says. The contract says, I don't like it, I can return it. And there's actually a wonderful webpage showing the travails of somebody from Australia trying to return Windows because she didn't agree with the license. So wholly apart from that interesting sidebar, it's thought by the court so far that if you have some opportunity to go back to the store, get your money back, that's enough to still bind you to the contract. Anybody have thoughts on opt? Forget about everything you know about doctrine so far. Just tell me,
should this behavior be something that the law has something to say about? Yeah,
Anna.
So which way do you want it to go?
I would, I'd probably be more open to actually trying a different solution and give dangerous insects to rethink traditional institutions.
How many of my teachers this year have hacked a copy detection scheme? Alright, how many non-MIT students have hacked a copy protection scheme in their life? Slightly lower number. How many tried? Nobody wants to admit to that. Here are some of the answers we got to this question. Alright, answer one from Mr. Gelber. Why might it feel different to steal a car on the copy defense copyrighted compact disc? Scarcity is obviously a primary issue. I take someone's car, they no longer have it. I copy a paper disc from someone, we're now both able to enjoy it. No one seems the wiser, because no one is directly harmed. Things in the act is not malum in se, but malum prohibitum. So that is a sort of cautionary note. Sounds like a great exam, right? You go one way and at the end, but I might be wrong. All right, so this actually seems to be all the copyright law should be in the dustbin, according to this author. Mr. Gelber here? Ooh. Mr. Gelber is not here. Next one.
Be
yes, exactly. James is aware that the price for access to the remaining celebrity photos and interviews was $9.95 for a batch of 20. She knew the method of paying with a credit card, which should be used by calling an 800 number. Despite this, she chose to gain the access by breaking the protection scheme. In doing so, she gained access to goods without actually paying for the goods. Why is that stealing? Why is it stealing? Why shouldn't they? I mean, certainly it would be stealing, right? If you think so, if she hacked into their system, she went onto the internet, broke into their server, and stole the interviews in the private directory. How many people think the law should criminalize that? The MIT students are still providing something to drag on that vote. How many people think that the law should penalize the car hypothetical? So what's the difference? Somebody who thinks that the first case is penalizable but the second isn't, what's the difference? Yeah?
First case is trespass.
Yeah. Is it trespass by electron?
You're going into someone's account or someone's private file, somewhere where you do not have the right to go by the same MyBase right principle. So simply, hey, I'm not letting you in, so you're not allowed in. And in that sense, you actually may be an active effort to break into the file.
Alright, so you're saying that if somebody actually breaks into your server, that's trespass. But if somebody breaks into a locked box you give them and tell them not to unlock it, that's not trespass. So you think that this new medium of distribution where you don't have to use networks should just be stillborn because the law is indulging in these weird notions of trespass by electron. Yes?
I think part of just piggyback on what he's saying, part of the turning point for me was that this is a marketing decision on the part of this company, and Lycon, that they realized that giving people access to their product for free would make them want it, and so I didn't think that there was a contract issue. Well, I said that they had no contract with her, basically, and also that because it was a marketing scheme by which they were attempting to use the fact that people had access to their product to give them the purchase more, the fact that she got it for free was fine. Just because they were playing with the market and she got one up, they got one leg up over.
So it's an all-fair, it's an arms race, she
right.
Helped them.
Essentially, that's the way I saw it, and so I didn't see it as her sort of trespassing because they opened the
gate. But if they open up their server such that somebody with the right password can get their stuff, and she tries every password in the dictionary, and finds the one that opens the door.
Well, I think
is that also fair game?
Right. I think also the turning point is that if you're going to develop this kind of program, a lot of what we talked about in this class in terms of internet is we want a foolproof product. And I think the mere fact that she was able to hack her way into being able to have access to all 20 files is evidence that the product that Lycon was putting forth wasn't good enough. And perhaps she should be rewarded for doing that, just so that somebody else later in the future will be able to create a better product.
This is wonderful. So the law should only penalize behavior that's impossible to do.
I think that's it.
I think that you took my point to an extreme. I'm not talking about a case.
She uses a supercomputer. She goes to jail. She manages to do it with some undergrad work, and she's in the clear.
I think that when we look at what the law should and should not do, we look at the harm to society overall. And I think in this particular case, another thing that I argue is looked at is there was no real harm. It wasn't like she took these 20 products in the hypothetical set that she started to market and sell it for her own. I mean, the hypothetical, I assume, was just going to be used for her own use. And because they put themselves out there like that, and she was able to overcome their marketing scheme. I thought it was great. I thought that last time
more power to it. It's like being able to crank call a crank caller. Star 6-9, a telemarketer. There's a certain visceral thing. The law shouldn't preclude that, right? If you can spam the spammer, why not?
Well, I think that you have to look at the cost and benefits to society. And I think that in terms of Star 69, there's a benefit to society to be able to find out who crank calls you. And so, I mean, I think in this particular context, I thought it's been a benefit to society that perhaps in the future a better lifetime would have to develop a better product, essentially.
Gotcha. All right, Mike.
I don't quite know where this is lawfully and what document, but there does seem to be some difference between using it yourself, mostly because if it's a really bad scheme, well, I don't know if you're but if it were a decent scheme, there would be relatively few people who would be capable of it. So there should be, in some sense, might be some difference between if I could do it or if I could turn around and sell the program to everyone else or they can do it. So if I can sell the cracking program.
Interesting. How many people think that if she shares the program she used to get at the free stuff that's on the CD, it wasn't meant to be free, how many would penalize that? How many don't understand what I'm talking about? I gotta try this again, because I know I'm gonna get more votes here. She goes ahead and broadcasts to the world, here's the secret code that unlocks the rest of the CD and gives you all these interviews. So lifetime leaders across the globe are fools if they call the 800 number. Law-abiding fools, but fools nonetheless. How many would say, now she's crossed the line, the law should punish that? Fewer than think she should be punished for having used the CD. This is survey error. Yeah,
So the
person who detonates the bomb is a lot more to blame than somebody who gives instructions in every heart box, here's how to build and detonate a bomb.
Yeah.
It's just for your information. Yeah.
I think this goes back to the trust thing that we're talking about in our class. The way that it's right now in real world, I don't know how many pieces from, we know that you can go on the internet and find crack codes for everything from Microsoft Word to programs that cost thousands of dollars. Photoshop, you can go download it, and then like, if you live long enough, you can find the codes.
There's even a term of art for this, isn't there?
Yeah.
What's it called again?
And I think this is basically, this is the way it has been operating for a while, and I think it's an issue of trust that normal low lighting are going, $1,000 worth of programs, but would rather go buy it, but started having to see the fight.
And that's the way the world should be, right? And like these students live in their own lawless world, and we all have to bear the
risk. And basically, it's the risk that the people that actually wouldn't have bought it anyways use the program, but the people that would have bought it still buy it. So there's actually, like it was said before, there's no harm to society, and the risk that should be internalized by this program.
Gotcha. Well, if here's one more comment from the sisters. If you simply crack the code, and this would be a case like the Beth Jane's ingenuity, because they couldn't be bothered to read 2,000 reviews, and the law should not intervene or impose a penalty. Her crime would be nothing more than simply cracking the code. If, however, she proceeded to make the interviews available, that would be a situation. Right, so that's now the third variant. She doesn't make the code available, she actually then starts purveying the interviews themselves, and that would be the problem. So
stop saying this case, she cracks the code, reasoning is because we can enjoy them. If the law should prescribe her behavior, her own punishment has already been self-dealt.
By the way, it's worth noting central point software actually was taken to court by Lotus in 1991 for producing commercial software that was back code on top of central software when they won. They were selling and they were initial business.
Maybe a central point software one. Now, interestingly, the outcome of that case might be different today. This is what comes to the final piece that Tara was getting at of new law today. And in the parlance I've been expounding, this is using new old rights to protect new rights. All right, what do I mean by that? I mean, it's saying, I'm talking about a new kind of right, the unit access right, the lightness right right. Different from the old kind of right that was what the law recognizes and vindicates through legal process as what you are and aren't allowed to do. And this says, what if we could use the law, the old style of rights, to help protect this new style of rights? Right? We're not having to go to the Congress anymore to strengthen copyright per se, but what if we could have them strengthen this new kind of right? And here we have the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. The DMCA, Section 1201, Circumvention of Copyright Protection Systems. Violations regarding circumvention of technological measures. No person shall circumvent a technological measure that effectively controls access to a work protected under this title. Prohibition contained in the same sentence shall take effect at the end of the 2-year period, blah, blah, blah. And they hack the blah, 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 meaning Congress is so conflicted over this that they actually are asking the librarian of Congress to do a study, and they're asking for comments, and there's a moratorium. But the direction it's going in, and the direction is, no person shall circumvent technological measures that effectively controls access to a work protected under this title. So what does it say? It says that if something is subject to copyright, so it doesn't include databases, but it might include interviews. And it's on CD-ROM, and it's protected effectively. This gets to your point about if they protect it legally, perhaps somebody who can just double-click and find the folder where they're hidden isn't suddenly a criminal. But if it effectively protects them, if you manage to break that effective protection, you go to jail. Yes?
What about computer viruses?
You mean are people who do computer viruses subject to liability under this?
Are people
who crack computer viruses?
Computer viruses
could the computer virus authors say, that's a copyrighted virus, I introduced on your machine, you have hacked it in order to solve it, how dare you? You go to jail.
Why not?
It's a wonderful question. I have no earthly idea. Yeah?
I have another technical question. With websites using HTML and still being
I suppose that would come down to the effectively language again. That word that effectively controls access. It's a weird word, and it gets to the paradox that was introduced over here about they have to go to some effort to lock the box, but not so much so that no one can unlock it unless they don't need the lock. So it's in that middle zone where they go to effort to lock it, and then you break it. Now, would reading literally the interviews off the sector-by-sector format of this? I don't know. There's no case law around this yet. There's no cases been brought under it. That'd be one of those borderline cases that would then become part of the doctrine surrounding the law. Harry, you're in trouble. Yes. Yes. And there's an idea of self-help schemes, so that if for the purposes of fair use you crack the scheme, right, because you can use a copyright management scheme to control access to a work protected under the title, which is just what the panel took out, but if you make the protection so strong you can't get fair use, is somebody allowed to hack to try to get it?
When they really realistically claim copyright protection, they've already protected it by
And the answer is yes, but it may depend on what you think the answer ought to be.
There's another issue here, though, which is that the algorithm used for the class rating mechanism may be different from the use rate as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
The other question is, when does that ever matter, the means for how difficult what to commit to that? I mean, it just, you know, reminds me of a mini bar in a hotel room. I mean, they put it right in your face in the same way that
and there are those potato chips staring out at you.
Sometimes it's grated where you can see, you know, through your almost stick your fingers to them. And it's a little loud, you can smash it with your shoe probably, and it doesn't matter how difficult it is to steal something. All that matters is that that's a perspective.
That's a wonderful point. In fact, if you were to leave the door to your house open and someone were to walk in and take everything, you wouldn't say, well, you didn't effectively control your contents. Those rights to your property don't inhere in how well you protect it. But notice here, this is where old rights and new rights are conflicting. Because in this context, yes, you can assert a copyright. If somebody rips off your stuff after hacking, you can still need to go after them for copyright infringement. Clearly, if Jane were to copy the stuff off the CD and pass them around, it's copyright infringement. Okay, but this is a step more. It says actually the act of hacking alone is a separate crime. The act of hacking. And indeed, it may even, yeah.
They have that if you use encryption on this, you get extra penalties. And so, to your point about your weapon, if you commit murder using a gun or a knife or a pull book, there's no difference necessarily in the charge and the weapon doesn't count. But here, if you're going to use encryption as mechanisms for doing this, it ups the penalty on top of it as well, which I think is even more complicated.
Yes. So, Alert and Talent, I know we have to have
just as an interesting term of art, I was reading an FBI briefing on that provision. And the FBI term of art for that provision is sentencing enhancement.
Sentencing enhancement. I think on the day.
So I see we're actually
out of time and apparently out of battery power on this microphone. I should offer a couple concluding words. If there's something maybe to take away from today, it is this thought. The perfect enforcement of non-existent laws. One thing that Internet 2000 may offer is much more finely grained control over information. We can give it to you, but not to you. We can say, I don't want any Republicans to read this document. Only Democrats can read it. You've got to show me the Democrat signed certificate before I'll give it to you. You have much more finely grained control possibilities that publishers may avail themselves of. And yet, these are laws that are not coming from Congress. These systems are coming from the technology. And Congress, if anything, is backing them up by something like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And how to have the argument that John Perry wants to have. John Perry wants to say, my God, these new systems are terrifying. We ought not to have them. But they're not coming about explicitly through act of Congress. They're coming about through market forces. So how to imagine having a policy argument on that is part of the recurring difficulty when the policy is not being made by Congress anymore. It's being made de facto by the private interests. So please join me in thanking our panel. And we'll see you all next week. Thank you.